Okay, so we're here now for the fifth reading of The Economics at the End of a Delusion by Lyndon LaRouche. The previous presentations or the previous workshops that we've all been through will be links in the description box, so people can refer back to those. Just to be very, very summary, I'm not going to do a big recap, but the last reading session 2 weeks ago, we were introduced to the question of what sort of language are we utilizing when mapping out the universe that we were created into? Obviously, there's different types of languages. Languages always have concepts at their root, at their heart. And mathematics is no exception. It is a self-consistent, self-contained language that has rooted assumptions built into it, as we've been looking at it various ways. We were introduced to the idea of Euclidean geometry and the mathematical shadows, aka mathematical formulas of the geometrical world that is created by somebody like a Euclid, which is again internally consistent. It is broad, but it is also flawed in a variety of very systematic ways that we've observed regarding blind assumptions. For example, the idea of the parallel postulate, that in this universe that Euclid would have us believe we live within, and that his language is supposed to map out or help us navigate through, it is presumed that space has certain characteristics, of which part of one of those primary characteristics is linearity, infinite linearity, and the idea that you could grow two parallel lines at perfect, let's say, perpendiculars, two perpendicular lines to another, meaning that they grow out from a third line at 90 degree angles that extend that way forever, maintaining that characteristic. Now, in the real universe, we've come to realize increasingly that space is not only not linear, it is not empty. It doesn't work that way. That even when you try to do something that is a perfectly straight thing, like using a laser beam, we've discovered that there is a curvature based upon the physical properties of the fields that are everywhere. We have electromagnetic fields. That we have what appears to be things like planets with space separating them. But when you look at different filters of the electromagnetic spectrum, we realize that is actually fully saturated space. It's an ocean of saturated substance. Sorry, my internet's very bad. I think it's because everybody in the household right now is using the internet for some pretty heavy reasons, and so it's just not equipped to handle this weight. If it happens again, we might have to abort today's reading because Cynthia's. I heard her a little agitated that her internet also crapped out at the same moment that ours did, so she gets precedent in this case. Okay, so yeah, just to return back. So in short, the question of language, what sort of language we choose to use to map out the universe is very important. And if we use a language which has no correlation to the actual nature of the universe that we were created into and are trying to make sense of and act upon in a lawful way, then we are really in trouble. So we were introduced to the fallacy of cybernetics, information theory, promoted by certain followers of Bertrand Russell, like Norbert Wiener, John von Neumann, the last reading, and how LaRouche at a young age grappled with their fallacies and came throughout through that attempt to refute their idea of an entropic universe that is a closed system, how he came to a lot of his insights into the anti-entropic nature, both of the universe, but also specifically of human economies, and how it is through the ability for creative leaps of discoveries to happen that we have the power to translate said immaterial metaphysical ideas into new technologies, which allow us to access greater portions of the electromagnetic spectrum that can be then harnessed and utilized. Like you can't have microwaves unless you discover microwaves, right? And then you can have the technology of microwaves. You could use that for a variety of things, telecommunication, other things, but you have to discover the spectrum. Same thing for the periodic table, same thing for the isotopes. The more you discover, the more you have a power to utilize nature's gifts in a way that improves the lives of people and overcomes the limits to growth. Very simple, very elementary, but not commonly understood. It's been very obscured, especially in our modern day. So this is something that LaRouche has been trying to hammer at for about 5 decades, and it's a theme that comes back again and again. In this particular writing that we're going to look at today, we're going to be introduced to the question of now arts in a certain way, arts, poetry, literature, and morality. So I think it's going to be a pretty potent concept or set of concepts. I don't have an ability to download the PDF. I've tried now several times. It fails every time. So I'm going to ask Pascal. Are you still there, Pascal? Okay, I'm going to ask Declan. Declan. So I'm going to make you, have you ever used Zoom as a co-host?
I can screen share. You want me to screen share?
Yeah, so I've just made you co-host. Would you go ahead and screen share that?
Okay, let's see. Okay, do you see?
There we go.
Okay.
So we can scroll down now to page 24, I believe.
Okay.
There it is.
It's page 27.
Oh,
That's
he's got it.
okay.
He's got it. The role of art in economics and morals. Or do we didn't go further than that, did we, Quan?
No. It's
We
the
just
perfect place.
continued.
It's a place that we start today.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it's literally page 27 on the EIR, but it's page 24 of 66 of this PDF. So it's good. It's what we're looking at
Okay.
is just great. So for today, since I'm going to try to stay quiet, plus my throat still hurts a little bit too, we just need a reader. Who would like to be today's first reader? Ooh, that's very big. Hey, Jonathan, would you like to read?
Yes, ju I'm just trying to find it on my computer here. One second.
You can't see it on this computer?
I can, but I'm not able to follow reading. I don't have that skill.
I can do it
Oh,
for a little
that's okay.
while.
Pardon me, Sadomi?
I could do it for a little while. I may have to leave early, but I could do it for a little while.
Oh, yeah, why
Okay,
don't
and
you?
I'll come in after. Yeah, cool.
Okay. Consider the role of art in economics and morals. Consider for a moment, as part of the indictment of the charlatans of information theory, a commonplace, relevant illustration of the kind of socially expressed economic dysfunction which the popularization of information theory and related practices has introduced to the design and use of manufactured products. Look at the degeneration in the functional qualities of material, which so-called tech writers have inserted into the typical product of description and use instructions accompanying the delivery of a manufactured product. Consider also a directly related pathology exhibited in the past decades, often disastrous, increasingly widespread substitution of benchmarking for competent design engineering. Then, after summarizing that case, contrast those indicated forms of cultural decadence to the qualities of communication which the classical English poet Percy, is it
I
Bysshe?
think it's Bysshe.
Bysshe Shelley identified as periods in history during which there is an increase of the power for imparting and receiving profound and impassioned conceptions respecting man and nature. It is readily shown that the effort to make a separation between matters of artistic composition and subjects such as physical science and economics reveals a moral impoverishment of the mind of the would-be scientist or economist. The included result of such an impoverishment will be inevitably a contribution to society's loss of economic potential. For example, of such a pathological influence, consider the following relative simple quality of clinical evidence. During and immediately following World War II, there was a significant and expanding resort to dividing the work of the scientist and engineer who designed the product from the writing of those descriptions and instructions supplied, which were prepared for the use by persons who came to be known as tech writers. At the outset, the resulting damage was apparently minimal. The tech writers tended to show actual conscience-stricken comprehension of the product they were describing. Over the years, especially with the introduction of the unconscionable fad called programmed learning, the always fragile functional relationship between the actual design of the product and the description by the tech writers became an increasingly troubled one. As it is said, the competent or relatively competent tech writers of the immediate post-war period into the 1950s took it from the top. In the instance of the information associated with the product of any reliable firm, the reader was usually given an overview of the subject being addressed and a sense of the relative functional relations among the sundry components and operations referenced in that report. Over time, the quality of tech writing became increasingly less coherent. The work product suggested something assembled from the snippets sent in from sundry places. The effect of this loss of coherence was that reading the finished combined results suggested more and more the image of a collage of lines, each written by one of a scattered herd of separate writers, many of whom were apparently on poor speaking terms with one another. The end result has been often something akin to the recurring nightmare of the guilt-ridden nerd. This problem, which was merely symptomized by the case of the apparently disintegrating mind of the evolving species of tech writers, was aggravated cataclysmically in the extreme by three social factors. First, the accelerating degeneration in public and higher education over the course of recent 35 years. This is typified by the influence of the 1963 OECD report on education issued by the influential Malthusian Dr. Alexander King. Second, the disastrous effect of the post-1963 spread of the rock drug sex cultural paradigm shift in destroying the intellectual and related emotional mission orientations of dedication to competence among secondary and higher education graduates. Third, the past 30 years process of combining intentional ruin of the former leading sectors of U.S. family farming and deindustrialization of urban industry, reflecting rabid devotion to free trade in general and outsourcing most emphatically. The effects of these trends were aggravated by the introduction of related, novel, and extremely irrational notions of the nature of intellectual property rights. A recent novelty expressing the same pathological trend is the idea of the patenting of John Q. Citizen's genes. This has the smell of something invented by the notorious Dr. Mengele, or perhaps H.G. Wells' Dr. Moreau. Over approximately the recent decade, under the impact of the process called globalization, even the mission expected of the tech writer and of the users of the product have undergone an additional qualitative change for the worse, to the effect of continually aggravated spread and intensification of functional illiteracy. From the evidence now at hand, it is implied that the tech writer usually assumes that the reader should not attempt to understand the product, but that he should obey literally and more or less blindly the instructions supplied. Usually, the instructions themselves are incompetent in one degree or another. Implicitly, at least, the idea that the provider has a moral responsibility for being either coherent or that the instructions should be competent has been abandoned. The peddler of the heavily outsourced product shrugs off the complaint as if to say, don't blame me, I don't make the stuff, I only sell it. If the instructions don't work, accept the fact that things are tough all over. Can someone explain that a little more clearly? Like, I can't understand the connection between the tech writer and the actual information. Is it meaning we're getting too technical and less creative?
He's talking about the steps of decay, that once we're much more organically, there used to be the two spheres of pure and applied knowledge used to be, they used to dance together more organically many decades ago. And there's been a process of detachment, disassociation of the designer of new, let's say machines, machine tools, and the so you design something in your mind, but then you have to build it. And when you build it, it requires technicians to come up with, you know, blueprints, outlines of the different parts that all have to work together in the machine, because the machine has a machine, depending on its complexity, has many different moving parts that have to work together. So there has to be a something being communicated through the minds of every person along the every phase of the operation down to the assembly line. And that's become increasingly fragmented and diminished in quality on every regard. And he described the compartmentalization process as one bad slip. You know, we're,
yes.
And I have a member of my family who works in AutoCAD, and they've told me this for many years, that they just work on a very tiny part. They're given a very specific thing that they have to work on every day. They don't know what the machine is that it does. They just have to work on that very specific part of a piston within an engine or something. But you've got, you know, dozens of people working on different localized parts, and nobody really gets to see what the whole is doing, even on such a simple thing. And he's now describing globalization, making that even worse. That was already bad. But now we have a process of, you know, greater decay based on first the slide into like a loss of value, where people now think you can have a value over intellectual property that is so pervert, like, because it's good to have intellectual property, right? It gives you an incentive to be creative. Why not? That's great. But then they've expanded that so that you could own life, you know, you could own seeds like Monsanto, or as he's saying, genes of animals, or even maybe humans. If you can just modify it in a laboratory, you can say, okay, it's my intellectual property, and make money off of that. And then he's going further, and he's making a comment of something I couldn't think of an example about, but I guess he's had that experience of the lack of consideration over the instructions that are written on how to use a machine or a product, and the actual functionality of the machine product that are not necessarily correlated.
Yes.
Now, I couldn't think of any examples where this has happened to me. So I don't know if anybody else has examples that LaRouche seems to feel strongly about in their world. I don't know.
Well, I think top secret. You know, those classified information.
I don't think he's talking about that. He's talking about more cheap stuff.
Yeah.
That is sold under globalization's, you know.
Yeah.
Order. There's one very current, if you like, reference that I can make, and that's to military quality. Been a lot of discussions of comparisons, if you like, between Russia, China, and America. You know, what would happen in a war? One of the problems that American technology has is it's made up of too many seemingly unrelated. And what I mean by unrelated is manufactured by different, you know, companies, et cetera, et cetera. All of which has to come together and work and be integrated.